Good morning and welcome to the Thursday edition of Byers & Company. This hour, we'll talk about the greatest spectacle in racing with the great Donald Davidson. Coach will be with us and maybe giving away some tickets courtesy of J.L. Hubbard Insurance and Bonds. It all starts now.
Byers & Company, WSOY 1340 AM, 103.3 FM, streaming live at nowdecatur.com.
Memorial Day is upon us, and one part of the Triple Crown of Motorsport takes place in Indianapolis, the Indy 500. Grill is the greatest spectacle in racing, and even non-race fans tune in Memorial Day weekend to watch the action. And it is our great pleasure to welcome to the program Donald Davidson. He is a member of the Auto Racing Hall of Fame, the Richard M. Fairbanks Indiana Broadcast Pioneers Hall of Fame, the USAC Hall of Fame, and in 2016, he was named Sagamore of the Wabash by Governor Mike Pence, which is an award that dates back several decades to Indiana citizens. I got the great pleasure to meet Mr. Davidson a couple of years ago in Indianapolis while we were doing a retreat. Thank you, sir. It's great to have you with us. I feel like I should say Mr. Davidson. Is it okay if I call you Donald?
I would. I wish you would. I was going to suggest that, please.
Let's start with your beginnings. How does a young boy growing up in Southwest England get this fascination with motorsports?
Oh, golly, how long do we have?
Plenty of time.
That's really hard to explain. It was a long time ago. Europeans were not participating in the Indianapolis 500, so most people didn't know what that was over there, believe it or not. But the British always embraced motor racing, Grand Prix racing, so I knew who the drivers were from the time I was a little boy, as did everybody. But when I was just entering my teens, I was probably 12, something clicked one day, and I started to read about the history of motor racing and found that I could memorize the Grand Prix winners and the seconds and the thirds, and then I eventually stumbled upon the fact that there was a thing called the Indianapolis 500, and it didn't have 176 turns like the Nürburgring in Germany or twisting, turning road course like Monaco. This had four left-hand turns and straightaways, and the drivers were people I wasn't familiar with, but I was fascinated by the names, fascinated by the car names. When I saw photographs of the cars, I fell in love with those and thought, I want to know more about this, and eventually go. So it took a while to save up the money. It took about 7 years. And as a young adult, I showed up, and my life changed completely because I was embraced by the participants. And I know this is a long answer. You should hear some of them. But I was just blessed that I just fell in love with this thing and was totally captivated by it. And yet I could end up coming over here, find out that the participants were just really nice people. And I just got the red carpet treatment from the time I arrived.
You are officially the historian of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And as I understand it, you're the only person to hold such a position on a full-time basis for any motorsports facility in the world. It's very unique what you do.
We believe that, yes. Yeah.
Okay, so let me ask you about it's described as a selective, retentive, easy access memory. That's a very big...
Well, you've done your homework.
Well, yes. I've seen you do this, so I know it's true. How would you describe it? Some people would say photographic memory. This gift you have for being able to remember everything.
Well, I've been given credit for having a photographic memory, and I do not. The difference is that photographic memory, you have the ability to memorize anything on an involuntary basis, and I could not and cannot do that. But I found that when I got obsessed by something, I could soak up information and retain it. Now, it didn't work for schoolwork. If it was, I had to be completely passionate about something in order for it to stick. And several people, I didn't go and get tested or lie down or go through, a battery of tests or anything, but I've had people come up to me and say, You know, what you have is selective, retentive, easy access. And so how it works, I have no idea. It's just like magic.
All right, but if I ask you the question, how many drivers named Smith have raced in the 500, you would be able to answer that question.
That's my favorite general interest piece of trivia about the track. Because even if you could care less about racing, the fact there's been 101 runnings of the 500 and I think 600 or 765 drivers, and the number of Smiths to compete is zero, which is just amazing. But it's true.
And that would be, you would think, here in America. Of course, in a race that is more known for the bigger names, the A.J. Foyts, the Al Unsers, the Rick Mears, you know, the Team Penske's, there's a lot of great obscure things. Why is it that, and you're going to have to help me out because I do not have the expertise, for so long green cars were considered to be bad luck?
Oh, it was green in general, and there's no explanation for that. There's several theories, but it goes back a long time, maybe to even before World War One, and just some people avoided the color green at all costs. But there were those who were a little defiant, so there was no rule against it. It's just that it. Some drivers can. Drivers used to be a very, very superstitious bunch. They're not anymore. If they are, some of them maybe privately, but it went beyond green cars. It was just anything green. Although the infield is green and the garage area was painted white and green, and at the victory banquet you were paid in dollars, which are. Green.
There you go.
But that's gone away now.
All right. Let me ask you about the Brickyard, where it gets its name. You know, back in 1909, I believe, is when they actually started paving it with bricks. There's only a yard left to recognize the historic brickwork. But how did that come about?
Well, the track was built in 1909, and the original surface was crushed rock and tar, which sounds terrible. But I just started thinking about this not too long ago. It may be the earliest paving job within the state because no roads were developed at that time. Some states, Illinois, for instance, was appropriating funds for the development of roads, but Indiana was not. And so it was a rather crude attempt at paving. And they probably made the mistake. I've often wondered because they had disasters at the motorcycle and the automobile races where they first ran because the surface wasn't ready yet. And, I mean, they tried to run on it immediately and spinning wheels and crushed rock and tar was not a happy mix when it hadn't settled yet. I've often wondered if they had laid it and left it for a few weeks or months, if they would have had the troubles that they did. Anyway, so they realized immediately we've made a mistake here, and so they looked around for another surface. Concrete was considered, and that no good because that would crack during, freeze in the winter and they'd be patching it forever. And so somebody came forth and said some states, their cities, they're now paving them with street paving bricks. And Vetersburg, Indiana, which is almost to the Illinois border, Danville, and that's where they manufacture bricks by the million. So I made a long story out of this, but they trucked in 3,200,000 paving bricks, and bricks and mortar was the entire surface laid down in the fall of 1909, and many of them came from almost to the Illinois border, and to this day, many of them are still there. I got asked a lot, well, the track's paved with asphalt now. Whatever happened to the bricks? Well, about probably 85-90% of the way around the track, they're still down there under several layers of asphalt.
We're visiting with Donald Davidson, the historian of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. All right, a three-part question here about the trophy. The Sterling Silver Borg Warner Trophy. When was it commissioned, what did it cost, and what is it worth today?
Okay, it was commissioned in 1935 and unveiled in 1936. That's the one with the bas-relief sculptures of all the winners on it. And I think it was supposedly had $10,000 worth of silver in it then, 1935-36. What it's insured for now, I don't know. It's probably a couple of million, I would think.
Absolutely. And then where did the drinking of the milk begin? What that great tradition, which is so singular to sports?
Well, there's a lot of other traditions like that, that some of them really don't make any sense. And some of them are very hard to track because they just sort of happened by accident and just evolved. And the milk is one of those, except we can track it. A driver named Louis Meyer, who ended up winning the 500 three times, regularly drank buttermilk. From the time he was a little boy, his mother told him that that would refresh him on a hot day. And so he drank buttermilk. And if he did it in 28, there's no photographic record. He claims that it was done in 33. No photographic record of that either. But certainly the 34, 35 winners did not drink milk or what appeared to be milk. But when Louis Meyer did in 1936, he was filmed. It was in the newsreels, in the theaters, with him holding up three fingers and drinking out of this bottle. And so an executive in the milk industry somehow said, hey, let's make sure that happens every year. And so that's how it started, except, of course, it's milk, not buttermilk. But it's just one of those things that just happened by accident.
All right. Tell me about just the size and the scope of the stadium itself. And I have been told that you can put an awful lot of very famous world monuments inside the Indy Oval. Is that true?
Yeah. Somebody did an experiment by, dropping in. Several football stadiums and the Vatican, and I don't remember all of that exactly, but I can tell you that the track is described as a rectangular-shaped oval, and I get a lot of laughs when I point out that that is a contradiction in terms, but it's the front stretch and the back stretch are 5/8 of a mile long, and at the north end and the south end, there's a short straight of 1/8 of a mile each, and they're joined by four turns that are exactly 440 yards. So you've got a drag strip turning left, and that all links up to make a 2.5 mile track. And the area inside of the oval, I think, is 224 acres. And the property is much greater than that, but stats are changing all the time. But the one thing that has not changed is the acreage inside of the oval. So 224 acres. And so the total, I mean, I think they own probably about 1,000 acres now because they bought up a lot of property over the decades for parking and so forth.
Okay, couple of trivia questions, and we'll get you out of here. Tell me, A.J. Foyt earned his first of his four victories in 1961. Who did he take the lead from, and on which lap?
Eddie Sachs, 197, I believe.
That's exactly right.
Sachs came in and made a tire stop, and if he probably could have babied it home to win, but Sachs elected to come in and stop.
All right, on May 30th, 1911, was the very first Indy 500. What was the original name, who was the winner, and what was his average speed?
Oh, I think they called it the International Sweepstakes in the early days, and the winner was Ray Haroon with relief from Cyrus Patchkey in a Marmon Wasp, car number 32, and that car is on display in the museum. And it's not a mock-up, it's the real thing.
Fantastic stuff. I know it's a busy week. We really appreciate you taking a few minutes to be with us. Donald Davidson, great pleasure. Enjoy your weekend.
My pleasure, thank you.
All right, great stuff. Yeah, the average speed was 74 miles an hour, by the way, in 1911.
Oh my gosh.
And instead of going, you went,
yeah.